Namaste and welcome to another edition of the Bharatvarta Weekly. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you to our viewers and our guests as well. So we have Ashish Chandorkar and Srivatsa Subbanna here to talk about the news and events of the week that was. This week was special. We also completed 1 year of Bharatvarta. We published our first episode on February 25th last year. And since then, it's been a fantastic ride. Hey, Ashish. Hey, Vatsa. How are you guys?
Good morning.
Good morning. Doing good.
Yeah, somebody also mentioned in the last comments that, you know, Bangalore weather is always good. Ashish will always eat poha and Vatsa's mic will always be on mute. So that was an interesting comment, right? Moving on, last week we put out this excellent episode, which was like a really comprehensive deep dive on the Kerala state elections coming up. I mean, it was... Rohit, of course, is an encyclopedia of knowledge, right, with these matters. And he was very well balanced by Anant as well. So, Vatsa, what do you think about this?
I think it's a fabulous, fabulous episode. For someone like me who doesn't know a lot about Kerala politics, and I think I'm pretty sure that even for those who know quite a bit about Kerala politics, they would have learned something new or figured out something new. You know, especially with Rohit, the thing is that, you know, when you think that there is another level of depth he can't go to when it comes to political insights, he always seems to find that next level.
Yeah.
And Anant also brought in, you know, that perspective of, as he called himself, an ex-communist and now a BJP sympathizer. They were very interesting sound bites and a lot of depth and detail about Kerala politics. So anyone who is interested in the upcoming elections in Kerala, I think should definitely watch this episode.
Yeah, certainly a fascinating episode. Okay, let's move on to the first item of news that we're going to cover. Prime Minister Narendra Modi ji inaugurated India's first toy fair yesterday. The toys in particular are made out of natural and eco-friendly material with natural colors. This is part of an initiative to use less plastic. The Prime Minister interacted with several toy clusters from across the country in a video conference. The fair aims to bring together various stakeholders associated with the sector. Vatsa, we've spoken about this you know, last year as well as part of the Atmanirbhar initiative that, you know, toys are one of the major exports from China. What do you make of this?
Yeah, I think before that, I think Ashish had spoken about it in our episode on China, where he mentioned some of these products that can easily be manufactured in India that don't require a lot of high technology. And India should start looking at manufacturing some of these in India domestically, right? Seems like the government has heard him. So the thing is, in August, right, was when the Prime Minister first mentioned this, the idea of a toy fair and manufacturing toys in India domestically. Before that, in December 2019, what the government had done was it had increased the import duty on toys from China. So that in itself would kind of make local manufacturers more competitive. So once the announcement was made, work kind of started, you know, towards organizing this. And in between, there were some policy initiatives and some steps taken by different states, right? So just to give, you know, a lay of the land kind of a thing, India's domestic toy industry is about $1.7-1.8 billion. Of this, $1.5 billion is imported. And of that, 90% comes from China and Taiwan. So that's about, give or take, $1.3-1.4 billion of toys. And a lot of these do not involve high-end manufacturing or, you know, anything that is high-tech. So they can easily be kind of manufactured in India. What was holding Indian industry back was that most toy manufacturing in India is in the unorganized sector. So their ability to churn out newer designs or, you know, come up with newer molds is restricted because they don't have access to capital because they're not at that scale where you know, they'll have access to the capital to come up with newer molds and keep coming up with newer toys. So what the government did was there are specific, you know, toy manufacturing clusters that have now been set up. These are in each of these 100% FDI is allowed, right? So that will bring in much needed foreign investment, and we'll be able to manufacture much higher quality toys in India. So, you know, about 8 clusters at the cost of 2,300 crores have already been approved by the government, and these will be using eco-friendly materials. So overall, I think from a sustainability point of view, from Atmanirbhar Bharat, from building capacity domestically to bringing down trade deficit, there are many, many such benefits. And we are seeing, you know, some of these foreign investment come in. For instance, Foxconn is setting up a 400-acre toy manufacturing cluster in Koppal. In Karnataka. I'm again going to be accused of being, you know, very biased towards Karnataka. But overall, there's a plan to set up 35 clusters, right, across India. So it's a great move, because this is what, you know, Ashish had also called a low-hanging fruit, and something that can be developed very quickly and will also generate jobs. So medium to long term, I think it's a very good move.
Yeah, we should definitely do a deep dive on Indian manufacturing, because plenty of action happening here. All right, moving on. India and Pakistan agreed to a ceasefire along the LOC in Jammu and Kashmir. The countries released a joint statement last Thursday that announced that you know, discussions were held and a mechanism for hotline contact is being discussed as well. India-Pakistan relations have been strained ever since the February 2019 Pulwama attack and the Balakot airstrike afterwards. Now, both sides have decided to use border flag meetings to deal with unforeseen situations. The ceasefire was agreed upon after over 10,000 cases of ceasefire violations that took place across the border over the past 3 years. The US has called this a quote-unquote positive step towards great peace. Ashish, we're seeing a period of relative peace both with China and Pakistan in some sense, right? So what's the big picture here?
I guess they are quite related, Kerry. What might have happened is that because the China disengagement happened, I think following that, soon after, we've seen this agreement which has been put in. This was quite surprising, because the last such agreement happened in 2003, in November 2003, which actually led to about 3 years of real ceasefire. Like, there was no bullets fired for about 3 years until the terrorism incidents raised its head again in India in 2005-06 window. And then, of course, things kind of went downhill from there. But this is quite interesting that without any expectation of this happening, a ceasefire has been announced. The announcement also said that Ajit Doval, India's national security advisor, has been in touch with his counterpart, Mohit Yusuf, and they actually met in a different country. Now, curiously, Mohit Yusuf immediately denied that. Once the ceasefire was announced, he took to Twitter and put a long thread saying that, well, this is all untrue, and he has never really spoken to Mr. Doval. But clearly, it seems coordinated at the highest levels, basically. And if you see the announcements preceding the ceasefire in the last 2-3 days, Pakistani army, General Bajwa made some comments around how things should be calm and cool, and that was, I think, the first, let's say, a soft statement which came after the Pulwama attacks. And incidentally, this was also the week of the anniversary of the Balakot bombing, second anniversary. So he made some soft comments. Then India allowed Imran Khan to fly over the Indian airspace to go to Sri Lanka. If you remember, Pakistan had disallowed flights of Indian president and prime ministers in the past after the Balakot bombing. But India kind of made a reversal to that practice, letting him overfly. And also, Imran Khan himself then said that, he's ready for talks in all counts and so on. Of course, he was also quite aggressive in his comments yesterday when they, quote-unquote, celebrate the downing of Abhinandan's plane. And But I think overall the sentiment seems pretty soft. My guess is that India is adopting the same strategy which we did with respect to Pakistan when the Modi government took over in 2014. He invited Nawaz Sharif, then the Pakistan Prime Minister, for his vote taking. He went to his house for a wedding, right? And basically, he kind of created a quote-unquote insurance. It's like a call option which he's buying, saying that we are trying everything which is with respect to Pakistan, but if they do something wrong, we cannot be blamed for it, right? So now that the Biden administration has taken over in the US, and we spoke about it at length, that they're not going to be friendly to India on some of these issues, especially actually on Kashmir, they may have a very hawkish stance against India. So I think India is also trying to just ensure that it is seen taking as the first steps towards normalizing things with Pakistan. So that whenever things go wrong, and unfortunately, as we know, Pakistan's military establishment will make sure that things do go wrong at some point. India will have an excuse to say that it was not really initiated by India, whatever retaliation India takes from there on. I think this is more like a one step back to ensure that the two steps forward we don't get accused of escalating tensions in the region when we take the two steps forward. So it seems like a tactical move, and I think also tying with the China de-escalation, because if Pakistan sees China as withdrawing from its positions, then it makes no sense to take an aggressive posture being a client state of China. So I think from their perspective also it makes sense.
Right. Next up, the world's largest cricket stadium has now been named after Prime Minister Narendra Modi. The stadium at Motera in Ahmedabad was conceptualized by the Prime Minister when he was the Chief Minister of Gujarat. The construction of this new stadium began in 2016 and was built at a cost of 800 crores. The rebuilt stadium will be part of the Sardar Vallabhbhai Patel Sports Enclave, which will span over 220 acres on the Sabarmati riverbank. Vatsa, a lot of people have taken exception to this announcement, especially the part about the naming this stadium and so on. What are your thoughts?
So, Carrie, I think before coming to the naming and, the controversy, let's just talk about this stadium. I think it's fantastic that we have, a stadium of this size, which can seat 132,000 spectators in India. And not just that, it has 11 pitches, which is the largest in the world. Apart from the fact that it's also going to be probably the world's fastest draining ground. So if there is, rainfall, the match can resume quickly. It's a world-class facility, and it's something we should be proud of, that the fact that such a, facility has come up in India at what I would think is it's not very expensive in terms of cost. So just to, give an example, when Wembley was rebuilt in 2007, it cost close to £800 million. So that's the difference we are talking about in terms of cost, right? Now coming to this controversy over naming, I really think it's a non-controversy. It's a controversy that has been created. Mr. Modi was heading the Gujarat Cricket Association till he became Prime Minister in 2014. And in India, it's a common practice. It's been happening that, heads of state cricket associations or BCCI have had stadiums named after them. So, for instance, if you look at the Wankhede Stadium in Mumbai, it was, first thing is it was built because the Mumbai Cricket Association wouldn't get enough tickets for test matches. So, it was that level of a fight that led to, building of a stadium. And then after that, it was named after the person who got it built, which was Mr. Wankhede, right? Similarly, you have the M.H. Chidambaram Stadium in Chennai, the Chinnaswamy Stadium in Bangalore, all of whom are named after former BCCI heads. So there is nothing new in terms of, naming a stadium, a cricket stadium, after the head of a local cricket body or the BCCI. If we're talking about, stadiums named after politicians and so on, I remember in the early years of ISL, the football league, 5 out of 8 teams used to play in, either the Jawaharlal Nehru Stadium or the Indira Gandhi Stadium. So if, for instance, Kerala Blasters was playing Delhi Dynamos home and away, they would be playing in a Jawaharlal Nehru Stadium, right? Not, and I mean, people can say that, oh, the names of the stadium are different in the sense that the Goa Stadium, even if it's a Jawaharlal Nehru Stadium, it's called Fatoda. But in the same way, even this stadium is called Motera, right? So that argument doesn't really hold good. So it's a complete, you know, non-issue that has been taken out of context and blown out of proportion, that a stadium has been named after someone who is the Prime Minister of India right now.
All right, fantastic. The BJP swept the Gujarat municipal elections by winning 483 of the 576 seats. The ruling party maintained their power over all six municipal corporations in the state. Their vote share in the state was 53.08%, the highest it's been in 25 years. Meanwhile, the INC won only 55 seats. Surat City Congress President Babu Rekha and Rajkot City Congress Chief Ashok Dangar have offered to resign from their positions following the news. AIMIM winning 7 seats. Ashish, what do you make of this?
Pretty incredible result, actually. We've been discussing local polls on weeklies for a while. We had discussed Rajasthan polls. We covered Punjab polls last week, Gujarat this week. There's generally a pattern in these polls that the ruling party tends to win because so, Kerry, if we were discussing about the Gujarat polls, we spoke about the municipal polls in Rajasthan and Punjab earlier. Typically, in these polls, the ruling party tends to win the seats because people expect that having the same municipal corporation as the state government, I mean, the party being the same, helps the city, right? So, in that sense, BJP has been strong, and that is not a surprise. But after 25 years of controlling practically all corporations and the state, the BJP actually managed to add 100 seats for these six corporations. And this was quite incredible. The new party president in the state, T.R. Patel, comes from Surat, which is kind of an unusual thing. Typically in Gujarat politics, the strong politicians have always come from either the central region of Ahmedabad and Gandhinagar or from Saurashtra type area. I mean, Saurashtra area, which is where the current CM Rupani comes from. So, for C.R. Patel, it was also a challenge to prove that he could, under his leadership, the party can actually retain these corporations. In fact, when the counting started, the things weren't as stark in Surat as well as in Vadodara. It looked like Congress will make some gains and there would be some inroads made. But by the end of the day, it seems like Congress was completely wiped off. In fact, it was a point in the Rajkot election counting where Congress had won zero. I mean, there were 50 seats declared and Congress had got nothing out of the first 50 seats. I think they won 4 towards the end, making it 68-4 in Rajkot. Same thing happened in Bhavnagar and in other places as well, where Congress kind of trailed off towards the end of the day. So the main story, I mean, apart from the fact that BJP, of course, had a very emphatic victory, and remember, we have the state elections in Gujarat coming up in about 18-19 months' time from here on. The other story, of course, was the rise of ARC in Surat, which is what you alluded to. 27 wards in Surat, which means that a lot of Congress votes seems to have shifted to ARC. Now, is it a structural thing? I'm not very sure. I think it seems like the local Congress leaders, especially from a couple of communities which have generally been anti-BJP, they all moved to AAP and that's how they took the vote with them. Similarly, in Ahmedabad, AIMIM winning 7 seats, I don't know if they won all 7 in Ahmedabad, but that's for a minimum of 4. I think that's another thing for cause of worry for Congress, where their vote seems to have shifted to a new player. In fact, Hardik Patel actually went on record saying that he was being ignored and he was not getting the right support from the other leaders in the party in the state. So, seems like a cause of worry for Congress, but puts BJP in a very strong position. What will be interesting to see will be how the leadership angle plays out for the state polls. Whether Mr. Rupani will lead the party or whether C.R. Patel will essentially take over the command, that remains to be seen. But pretty good results for the BJP.
All right, moving on. Police found 20 explosive gelatin sticks in a vehicle near the Ambani residence. It weighed about 2.5 kilos. They said the explosives had a potential for an impact area of over 3,000 square feet. They've registered an FIR against unidentified persons. In similar news, more than 100 gelatin sticks and 350 detonators were seized from a passenger train in Kerala. The passenger was a woman traveling from Tiruvannamalai in Tamil Nadu. She claimed that the explosives were being used to break rocks and dig a well in Thalassery. What's a pretty random news, right? Whoa. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, Kerry. So I think, first of all, I don't think at prima facie that these two news bits are related. The one on Ambani is definitely more, you know, sort of worrisome in the sense that the vehicle came from outside BMC limits. It came from Navi Mumbai. And from there, it crossed like most of the city to reach, you know, somewhere close to Antilia where the Ambani stay. The other thing is, you know, how did they get this far without being tracked? So that is something the investigators have to answer, and I'm sure they will. The other incident, you know, that this is something that we see quite a bit, you know, especially in states where quarrying happens, right? The easy availability of explosives, especially gelatin sticks, you know, for quarrying, people use it for digging wells and so on, for construction activity. The amount of regulation around this on, you know, where from where people can buy it, are they trained to use some of these explosives? There seem to be a lot of gaps. Even, you know, earlier this month, there was an accident in Chikbalapur where six people died because they were trying to dispose of gelatin sticks. So I think that seems to be the worrying trend here rather than, you know, looking at it as a potential sort of terrorist threat. At this stage, it's too early to say that. But the usage and availability of explosives so easily, you know, for people, whether it's quarrying or construction, I think is something that's worrying. I think that's something the state governments need to look at. I know there are some steps being taken in Karnataka to regulate the availability and handling, but I think it needs to be done across the board.
All right, in some positive news, we're finally seeing India's GDP turn positive. This is after the pandemic struck. After a contraction of two quarters, the GDP was reported to have a marginal growth of 0.4% in the October to December category. The government said that this was due to, within quotes, astute handling of the lockdown and a calibrated fiscal stimulus. Q1 and Q2 of FY20 saw the Indian economy contract by 24.4% and 7.5% respectively. The manufacturing and construction sector saw a significant recovery in the December quarter. Ashish, break this down for our viewers. I mean, does this mean that, you know, we're bouncing back and this is a recovery in full swing?
Yes, this was expected. Most of the forecasts by economists of different banks put the GDP in the positive territory. In fact, if anything, it has been on the lower side. The 0.4% growth figure for Q3 is actually lower than the consensus numbers, which a lot of, well, not the consensus numbers, but the estimates which were put out by various economists. In fact, the lowest estimate was more like 0.5, 0.6% by SBI. So the fact that it was 0.4% of the GDP actually may shows that the recovery has not fully set in. Now, if you look at the components, what were announced, there are two sectors where there was a negative, the contraction kind of continues. One was, of course, on the services side, trade, tourism, all of that, hospitality. So all the services which are in-person, high-tech services, there was still a contraction of about 7%. That's understandable because even if the economy is opened up, people aren't traveling as much or they're not really moving around as much. So that was one area. The other area, surprisingly, was the government spending. The government spending continues to contract, but at a lower pace. This time it was minus 1.5%. So it seems that the government is right now, you know, letting the private sector-led recovery be and basically using a counter-cyclical type approach. So when when the private sector loses steam, the government will then step in. So probably they are keeping the powder dry for the next financial year. But as looks like that Q3 and now, of course, also Q4, where the tax collection, at least for the first month, seems to be, will be pretty high. We'll get to know the figure tomorrow for January. The expectation is that it will be pretty high, like in the 1,20,000 crore kind of a range. 1,20,000 crore kind of a range. So I think given that that is the expectation, the government probably wants to intervene maybe next year and not in this quarter. So overall positive. I mean, the fact that India still expects to contract by about 8% for the year, which also means that the government will pay off some of the subsidies this year, which is also a good sign that they are just cleaning up the books and they're using the bad year to essentially dump everything one shot and start new year on a positive note. So I mean, what really matters is that while all the high frequency indicators are going well, the indirect tax base is growing. The direct tax base also was going to surprise, apparently. That's been the estimate. Excise duty collection with the high taxes on petrol and diesel has been pretty high. They are going to bust the government, the budgeted estimates. Things like, you know, toll collections, electricity consumption, number of e-way bills being generated, all of this is in the positive territory. So it seems like the recovery is broad-based. The joker in the pack, of course, is when the NCLT proceedings resume. Will there be many more bankruptcy cases filed, or there would be claims against relatively smaller companies in the MSME sector? I mean, what has been the permanent damage there? That remains the open question, and we will not know the answer until, let's say, April, when the whole NCLT proceedings resume. Currently, they've been suspended due to the pandemic for a year. So again, I mean, cautiously optimistic. The forecasts for next year are, of course, between 11% and 15%, depending on whose forecast you read. Even if it had at a lower end of 11-12%, that would be pretty good, and that would set India back on the path of the 5 trillion mark, perhaps with a delay of a year or so, what the government had set for.
Right. All right, so that's a wrap from us. Before we wind up, here is some of the user love and support that, corporate habits can't help. here is some of the user love that we've been getting, right? I mean, thank you so much for all of your encouraging words. I mean, it really keeps us motivated. Thank you, Hemang Bhai. I hope, it becomes a ritual for more people that Adrak Chai, Poha and Bharatvarta weekly. You can replace the poha with, you know, steaming hot idlis and sambar if you want, right? So fantastic. Another great week for us. We have a couple of really cool episodes coming up. In fact, we're going live today, this evening, right? Ashish, what are you looking forward to with talking to Neha Joshi?
Yeah, Neha is a regular TV panelist. She's a national spokesperson for the Bharatiya Janata Yuva Morcha. She talks about political and social issues quite regularly, almost every day, on national television. So quite exciting to get her perspective on what the regulation of social media and OTT content means and the government's view of where this is coming from. Of course, we have discussed this topic in the past, so we do have some point of view of our own as well. That should be live at 6:30 p.m. today, right, Kerry? And I think that we should wind up before Neha's TV appearances start. That's the idea.
Yeah. No, it's going to be live at 6:30. Please check our social feeds for the link. And of course, we'll announce it a bunch of times. Do join in, ask your questions. We also have a fantastic episode coming up on the whole farmers protest, right? And this is going to have, of course, Ashish, and also he'll be joined by Anand Ranganathan, who you would have heard in a previous episode as well, and of course needs no introduction. We're also doing this in collaboration with Sunil Sharma of the Commonwealth Friends of Conservative Friends of the Commonwealth, right? Which is a very interesting organization. Ashish, care to talk a little bit about the collaboration?
Yeah, so the Conservative Friends of Commonwealth actually works with the as the name suggests, conservative or the right wing quote unquote parties of various Commonwealth countries. It's a UK-based organization. Several MPs in UK, several ministers in UK, and of course from countries like Canada, New Zealand, Australia, even the Caribbean countries, many of them are the are patrons or participants in their discussions. They don't have as much presence in the Indian political circle, and their audience in UK, which is not a lot of them are actually in Indian origin as such. They are simply, or even if they are Indian origin, they would be like British citizens or the first second generation British folk. So they want to understand what's happening in India with respect to farmer protest. What is the genuine part? What is the political part behind it? What are the real issues in the agriculture sector? And of course, Anand, as I said, no need to that thinking about this one in the debate centrally. So they requested to have a joint episode where their members can understand this better. And we will try to unpack this whole area, the whole agriculture sector, for the UK audience this time. Of course, the episode will still be available on our platform once it is recorded.
Yeah, no, it's pretty interesting, especially, you know, interest from outside of India, right, in terms of making sense of what's happening in India, because I think people do recognize there's a certain slant in the narrative that is built in the foreign press, which, of course, we have covered in depth, you know, on a couple of episodes with Ruchir Sharma and Vishal, right? All right, so that's a wrap from us. Thank you so much for joining us, and we hope to catch you on another episode. As usual, skip the news and watch the weekly. It's good for health. From Ashish and Vatsa, until next time, stay safe, take care, and Jai Hind. Thank you.